This is Audible.
Preface to the Third Edition. 30 years have now passed since the initial publication of Getting to Yes. We are delighted and humbled that so many people from so many places around the world continue to find it helpful in transforming their conflicts and negotiating mutually satisfying agreements. Little did we know at the time of its publication that this slender book would become a reference point in a quiet revolution that has, over the course of 3 decades, changed the way we make decisions within our families, organizations, and societies. The Negotiation Revolution. A generation ago, the prevailing view of decision-making in most places was hierarchical. The people at the top of the pyramids of power, at work, in the family, in politics, were supposed to make the decisions, and the people at the bottom of the pyramids to follow the orders. Of course, the reality was always more complicated. In today's world, characterized by flatter organizations, faster innovation, and the explosion of the internet, it is clearer than ever that to accomplish our work and meet our needs, we often have to rely on dozens, hundreds, perhaps thousands of individuals and organizations over whom we exercise no direct control. We simply cannot rely on giving orders, even when we are dealing with employees or children. To get what we want, we are compelled to negotiate. More slowly in some places, more rapidly in others, the pyramids of power are shifting into networks of negotiation. This quiet revolution, which accompanies the better-known knowledge revolution, could well be called the Negotiation Revolution. We began the first edition of Getting to Yes with the sentence, "Like it or not, you are a negotiator." Back then, for many listeners, that was an eye-opener. Now, it has become an acknowledged reality. Back then, the term negotiation was more likely to be associated with specialized activities, such as labor talks, closing a sale, or perhaps international diplomacy. Now, almost all of us recognize that we negotiate in an informal sense with just about everyone we meet from morning to night. A generation ago, the term negotiation also had an adversarial connotation. In contemplating a negotiation, the common question in people's minds was, who is going to win and who is going to lose? To reach an agreement, someone had to give in. It was not a pleasant prospect. The idea that both sides could benefit, that both could win, was foreign to many of us. Now it is increasingly recognized that there are cooperative ways of negotiating our differences, and that even if a win-win solution cannot be found, a wise agreement can still often be reached that is better for both sides than the alternative. When we were writing Getting to Yes, very few courses taught negotiation. Now, learning to negotiate well is accepted as a core competence, with many courses offered in law schools, business schools, schools of government, and even in quite a few primary, elementary, and high schools. In short, the negotiation revolution is now in full sway around the world, and we take heart that the common sense tenets of principal negotiation have spread far and wide to good effect. The work ahead. Still, while progress has been considerable, the work is far from done. Indeed, at no time in the last 3 decades can we recall a greater need for negotiation based on a joint search for mutual gains and legitimate standards. A quick survey of the news on almost any day reveals the compelling need for a better way to deal with differences. How many people, organizations, and nations are stubbornly bargaining over positions? How much destructive escalation results in bitter family feuds, endless lawsuits, and wars without end? For lack of a good process, how many opportunities are being lost to find solutions that are better for both sides? Conflict remains, as we have noted, a growth industry. Indeed, the advent of the negotiation revolution has brought more conflict, not less. Hierarchies tend to bottle up conflict, which comes out into the open as hierarchies give way to networks. Democracies surface rather than suppress conflict, which is why democracies often seem so quarrelsome and turbulent when compared with more authoritarian societies. The goal cannot and should not be to eliminate conflict. Conflict is an inevitable and useful part of life. It often leads to change and generates insight. Few injustices are addressed without serious conflict. In the form of business competition, conflict helps create prosperity. And it lies at the heart of the democratic process, where the best decisions result not from a superficial consensus, but from exploring different points of view and searching for creative solutions. Strange as it may seem, the world needs more conflict, not less. The challenge is not to eliminate conflict, but to transform it. It is to change the way we deal with our differences, from destructive, adversarial battling to hard-headed, side-by-side problem-solving. We should not underestimate the difficulty of this task, yet no task is more urgent in the world today. We are living in an age that future anthropologists might look back on and call the first human family reunion. For the first time, the entire human family is in touch, thanks to the communications revolution. All 15,000 or so tribes or language communities on this planet are aware of one another around the globe. And as with many family reunions, it is not all peace and harmony, but marked by deep dissension and resentment of inequities and injustices. More than ever, faced with the challenges of living together in a nuclear age on an increasingly crowded planet, for our own sake and the sake of future generations, we need to learn how to change the basic game of conflict. In short, the hard work of getting to yes has just begun. This edition, we have often heard from listeners that getting to yes continues to serve as an accessible guide to collaborative negotiation in a wide variety of fields. At the same time, we realize a younger audience is sometimes puzzled by stories and examples that were common knowledge 30 years ago, and many listeners are curious about contemporary cases. So in this edition, we have undertaken a careful revision and updating of examples and added some new ones where appropriate. We have added to our toolbox considerably in 30 years, as captured in such books as Getting Past No, Difficult Conversations, Beyond Reason, and The Power of a Positive No, each of which explores important challenges in dealing collaboratively and effectively with serious differences. We've made no attempt to summarize all of that material here, since one of the virtues of getting to yes is that it is short and clear. Instead, in this revision, we've added a few relevant ideas where they help clarify our intent, and in other places made slight revisions to update our thinking. For example, we've made our answer to the final question in the book about negotiation power fully consistent with the 7 elements of negotiation framework we teach at Harvard Law School. One adjustment we considered, but ultimately rejected, was to change the word separate to disentangle and separate the people from the problem, the powerful first step in the method of principled negotiation. Some listeners have taken this phrase to mean leave aside the personal dimension of negotiation and just focus on the substantive problem, or to ignore emotional issues and be rational. That is not our intent. Negotiators should make dealing with people issues a priority from the beginning to the end of a negotiation. As the text states at the start, negotiators are people first. Our belief is that by disentangling the people from the problem, you can be soft on the people while remaining hard on the problem. So long as you remain respectful and attentive to people issues, you should be able to strengthen a relationship even as you disagree about substance. Finally, we have added a bit of material on the impact of the means of communication and negotiation. The growth of email and texting and the creation of global virtual organizations has made this an important variable, especially in light of research showing its impact on negotiation dynamics and results. Our human future. We are each participants in a pioneering generation of negotiators. While negotiation as a decision-making process has been around since the beginning of the human story, never has it been so central to human life and the survival of our species. As the negotiation revolution unfolds, our aspiration is that the principles in this book continue to help people, individually and collectively, negotiate the myriad dilemmas in their lives. In the words of the poet Wallace Stevens, "After the final no, there comes a yes, and on that yes, the future world depends." We wish you much success in getting to that yes. Preface to the second edition. During the last 10 years, negotiation as a field for academic and professional concern has grown dramatically. New theoretical works have been published, case studies have been produced, and empirical research has been undertaken. 10 years ago, very few professional schools offered courses on negotiation. Now they are all but universal. Universities are beginning to appoint faculty who specialize in negotiation. Consulting firms now do the same in the corporate world. Against this changing intellectual landscape, the ideas in Getting to Yes have stood up well. They have gained considerable attention and acceptance from a broad audience and are frequently cited as starting points for other work. Happily, they remain persuasive to the authors as well. Most questions and comments have focused on areas in which the book has proven ambiguous or where listeners have wanted more specific advice. We have tried to address the most important of these topics in this revision. Rather than tampering with the text and asking listeners who know it to search for changes, we have chosen to add new material in a separate section at the end of the second edition. The main text remains complete and unchanged from the original, except for updating the figures and examples to keep pace with inflation, and rephrasing in a few places to clarify meaning and eliminate sexist language. We hope that our answers to 10 questions people ask about getting to yes prove helpful and meet some of the interests listeners have expressed. We address questions about 1, the meaning and limits of principal negotiation. It represents practical, not moral, advice. 2, dealing with someone who seems to be irrational or who has a different value system, outlook, or negotiating style. 3, questions about tactics, such as where to meet, who should make the first offer, and how to move from inventing options to making commitments. And 4, the role of power in negotiation. More extensive treatment of some topics will have to await other books. Listeners interested in more detail about handling people issues in negotiation, in ways that tend to establish an effective working relationship, might enjoy Getting Together, Building Relationships as We Negotiate, by Roger Fisher and Scott Brown. If dealing with difficult people and situations is more your concern, look for Getting Past No, Negotiating in Difficult Situations by William Ury. No doubt other books will follow. There is certainly much more to say about power, multilateral negotiations, cross-cultural transactions, personal styles, and many other topics. Once again, we thank Marty Linsky, this time for taking a careful eye and a sharp pencil to our new material. Our special thanks to Doug Stone for his discerning critique, editing, and occasional rewriting of successive drafts of that material. He has an uncanny knack for catching us in an unclear thought or paragraph. This is William Ury on behalf of Roger Fisher, Bruce Patton, and myself.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In, by Roger Fisher and William Ury. And for the revised editions, Bruce Patton of the Harvard Negotiation Project. Read by Dennis Pinsukaris.
Introduction. Like it or not, you are a negotiator. Negotiation is a fact of life. You discuss a raise with your boss. You try to agree with a stranger on a price for his house. Two lawyers try to settle a lawsuit arising from a car accident. A group of oil companies plan a joint venture exploring for offshore oil. A city official meets with union leaders to avert a transit strike. The United States Secretary of State sits down with his Russian counterpart to seek an agreement limiting nuclear arms. All these are negotiations. Everyone negotiates something every day. Like Molière's Monsieur Jourdain, who was delighted to learn that he had been speaking prose all his life, people negotiate even when they don't think of themselves as doing so. You negotiate with your spouse about where to go for dinner and with your child about when the lights go out. Negotiation is a basic means of getting what you want from others. It is back-and-forth communication designed to reach an agreement when you and the other side have some interests that are shared and others that are opposed, as well as some that may simply be different. More and more occasions require negotiation. Conflict is a growth industry. Everyone wants to participate in decisions that affect them. Fewer and fewer people will accept decisions dictated by someone else. People differ, and they use negotiation to handle their differences. Whether in business, government, or the family, people reach most decisions through negotiation. Even when they go to court, they almost always negotiate a settlement before trial. Although negotiation takes place every day, it is not easy to do well. Standard strategies for negotiation often leave people dissatisfied, worn out, or alienated, and frequently all three. People find themselves in a dilemma. They see two ways to negotiate, soft or hard. The soft negotiator wants to avoid personal conflict and so makes concessions readily to reach agreement. He or she wants an amicable resolution, yet often ends up exploited and feeling bitter. The hard negotiator sees any situation as a contest of wills in which the side that takes the more extreme positions and holds out longer fares better. He or she wants to win, yet often ends up producing an equally hard response that exhausts the negotiator and his or her resources and harms the relationship with the other side. Other standard negotiating strategies fall between hard and soft, but each involves an attempted trade-off between getting what you want and getting along with people. There is a third way to negotiate, a way neither hard nor soft, but rather both hard and soft. The method of principled negotiation developed at the Harvard Negotiation Project is to decide issues on their merits rather than through a haggling process focused on what each side says it will and won't do. It suggests that you look for mutual gains whenever possible, and that where your interests conflict, you should insist that the result be based on some fair standards independent of the will of either side. The method of principled negotiation is hard on the merits, soft on the people. It employs no tricks and no posturing. Principled negotiation shows you how to obtain what you are entitled to and still be decent. It enables you to be fair while protecting you against those who would take advantage of your fairness. This book is about the method of principled negotiation. The first chapter describes problems that arise in using the standard strategies of positional bargaining. The next four chapters lay out the four principles of the method. The last three chapters answer the questions most commonly asked about the method. What if the other side is more powerful? What if they will not play along? And what if they use dirty tricks? Principled negotiation can be used by diplomats in arms control talks, investment bankers negotiating corporate acquisitions, and by couples in deciding everything from where to go for vacation to how to divide their property if they get divorced. It is even a staple of hostage negotiators seeking the release of kidnap victims. Anyone can use this method. Every negotiation is different, but the basic elements do not change. Principled negotiation can be used whether there is one issue or several, two parties or many, whether there is a prescribed ritual, as in collective bargaining, or an impromptu free-for-all, as in talking with hijackers. The method applies whether the other side is more experienced or less, a hard bargainer or a friendly one. Principled negotiation is an all-purpose strategy. And like almost all other strategies, if the other side learns this one, it does not become more difficult to use, it becomes easier. If they listen to this book, all the better. Part 1. The Problem. Chapter 1. Don't Bargain Over Positions. Whether a negotiation concerns a contract, a family quarrel, or a peace settlement among nations, people routinely engage in positional bargaining. Each side takes a position, argues for it, and makes concessions to reach a compromise. The classic example of this negotiating minuet is the haggling that takes place between a customer and the proprietor of a second-hand store. Customer: how much do you want for this brass dish? Shopkeeper: that is a beautiful antique, isn't it? I guess I could let it go for $75. Oh, come on, it's dented. I'll give you $15. Really? I might consider a serious offer, but $15 certainly isn't serious. Well, I could go to $20, but I would never pay anything like $75. Quote me a realistic price. Oh, you drive a hard bargain, young lady. $60 cash, right now. $25. It cost me a great deal more than that. Make me a serious offer. $37.50. That's the highest I will go. Have you noticed the engraving on that dish? Next year, pieces like that will be worth twice what you paid today. And so it goes, on and on. Perhaps they will reach agreement, perhaps not. Any method of negotiation may be fairly judged by three criteria. It should produce a wise agreement, if agreement is possible. It should be efficient. And it should improve, or at least not damage, the relationship between the parties. A wise agreement can be defined as one that meets the legitimate interests of each side to the extent possible, resolves conflicting interests fairly, is durable, and takes community interests into account. The most common form of negotiation, illustrated by the previous example, depends upon successively taking and then giving up a sequence of positions. Taking positions, as the customer and storekeeper do, serves some useful purposes in a negotiation. It tells the other side what you want. It provides an anchor in an uncertain and pressured situation. And it can eventually produce the terms of an acceptable agreement. But those purposes can be served in other ways, and positional bargaining fails to meet the basic criteria of producing a wise agreement efficiently and amicably. Arguing over positions produces unwise outcomes. When negotiators bargain over positions, they tend to lock themselves into those positions. The more you clarify your position and defend it against attack, the more committed you become to it. The more you try to convince the other side of the impossibility of changing your opening position, the more difficult it becomes to do so. Your ego becomes identified with your position. You now have a new interest in saving face and reconciling future action with past positions, making it less and less likely that any agreement will wisely reconcile the party's original interests. The danger that positional bargaining will impede a negotiation was well illustrated in 1961 by the breakdown of the talks under President John F. Kennedy for a comprehensive ban on nuclear testing, which, if enacted, might have headed off much of the superpower arms race that ensued over the next three decades. A critical question arose: how many on-site inspections per year should the Soviet Union and the United States be permitted to make within the other's territory to investigate suspicious seismic events? The Soviet Union finally agreed to 3 inspections. The United States insisted on no less than 10. And there, the talks broke down over positions. Despite the fact that no one understood whether an inspection would involve one person looking around for one day or 100 people prying indiscriminately for a month, the parties had made little attempt to design an inspection procedure that would reconcile the United States' interest in verification with the desire of both countries for minimal intrusion. Focusing on positions nearly led to unnecessary bloodshed in a dispute between farmers and the National Oil Company in Iraq after the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime. Displaced farmers in the south of Iraq had banded together, leased arable land from the government, and used their last savings and borrowings to plant crops. Unfortunately, only a few months later, the farmers received a letter calling for them to vacate the land immediately in accord with the fine print of their lease, because oil had been discovered under it. The oil company said, "Get off our land." The farmers replied, "It's our land, and we're not leaving." The oil company threatened to call the police. The farmers said, "There are more of us," so the National Oil Company threatened to bring in the army. "We have guns, too. We aren't leaving," came the reply. "We have nothing left to lose." As troops gathered, bloodshed was averted only by the last-minute intervention of an official fresh from a training program in alternatives to positional bargaining. "How long years will it be before you expect to produce oil on this land?" he asked the National Oil Company. "Probably 3 years," they replied. "What do you plan to do on the land over the next few months?" "Mapping, a little seismic surveying of the underground layers." Then he asked the farmers, "What's the problem with leaving now, as they've asked?" "The harvest is in 6 weeks. It represents everything we own." Shortly thereafter, an agreement was reached. The farmers could harvest their crops. They would not impede the oil company's preparatory activities. Indeed, the oil company hoped soon to hire many of the farmers as laborers for its construction activities, and it did not object if they continued to plant crops in between oil derricks. As illustrated in these examples, the more attention that is paid to positions, the less attention is devoted to meeting the underlying concerns of the parties. Agreement becomes less likely. Any agreement reached may reflect a mechanical splitting of the difference between final positions, rather than a solution carefully crafted to meet the legitimate interests of the parties. The result is frequently an agreement less satisfactory to each side than it could have been, or no agreement at all, when a good agreement was possible. Arguing over positions is inefficient. The standard method of negotiation may produce either agreement, as with the price of a brass dish, or breakdown, as with the number of on-site inspections. In either event, the process takes a lot of time. Bargaining over positions creates incentives that stall settlement. In positional bargaining, you try to improve the chance that any settlement reached is favorable to you by starting with an extreme position, by stubbornly holding to it, by deceiving the other party as to your true views, and by making small concessions only as necessary to keep the negotiation going. The same is true for the other side. Each of those factors tends to interfere with reaching a settlement promptly. The more extreme the opening positions and the smaller the concessions, the more time and effort it will take to discover whether or not agreement is possible. The standard minuet also requires a large number of individual decisions, as each negotiator decides what to offer, what to reject, and how much of a concession to make. Decision-making is difficult and time-consuming at best. Where each decision not only involves yielding to the other side, but will likely produce pressure to yield further, a negotiator has little incentive to move quickly. Dragging one's feet, threatening to walk out, stonewalling, and other such tactics become commonplace. They all increase the time and costs of reaching agreement, as well as the risk that no agreement will be reached at all. Arguing over positions endangers an ongoing relationship. Positional bargaining becomes a contest of will. Each negotiator asserts what he will and won't do. The task of jointly devising an acceptable solution tends to become a battle. Each side tries through sheer willpower to force the other to change its position. "I'm not going to give in. If you want to go to the movies with me, it's Avatar or nothing." Anger and resentment often result as one side sees itself bending to the rigid will of the other, while its own legitimate concerns go unaddressed. Positional bargaining thus strains and sometimes shatters the relationship between the parties. Commercial enterprises that have been doing business together for years may part company. Neighbors may stop speaking to each other. Bitter feelings generated by one such encounter may last a lifetime. When there are many parties, positional bargaining is even worse. Although it is convenient to discuss negotiation in terms of two persons, you and the other side, in fact, almost every negotiation involves more than two persons. Several different parties may sit at the table, or each side may have constituents, higher-ups, boards of directors, or committees with whom they must deal. The more people involved in a negotiation, the more serious the drawbacks to positional bargaining. If some 150 countries are negotiating, as in various United Nations conferences, positional bargaining is next to impossible. It may take all to say yes, but only one to say no. Reciprocal concessions are difficult. To whom do you make a concession? Yet even thousands of bilateral deals would still fall short of a multilateral agreement. In such situations, positional bargaining leads to the formation of coalitions among parties whose shared interests are often more symbolic than substantive. At the United Nations, such coalitions often produce negotiations between the North and the South, or between the East and the West. Because there are many members in a group, it becomes more difficult to develop a common position. What is worse, once they have painfully developed and agreed upon a position, it becomes much harder to change it. Altering a position proves equally difficult when additional participants are higher authorities who, while absent from the table, must nevertheless give their approval. Being nice is no answer. Many people recognize the high costs of hard positional bargaining, particularly on the parties and their relationship. They hope to avoid them by following a more gentle style of negotiation. Instead of seeing the other side as adversaries, they prefer to see them as friends. Rather than emphasizing a goal of victory, they emphasize the necessity of reaching agreement. In a soft negotiating game, the standard moves are to make offers and concessions, to trust the other side, to be friendly, and to yield as necessary to avoid confrontation. The following examples illustrate two styles of positional bargaining, soft and hard. If you're using a soft style of positional bargaining, participants are friends. If you're using a hard style of positional bargaining, participants are adversaries. Soft style, the goal is agreement. Hard, the goal is victory. Soft, make concessions to cultivate the relationship. Hard, demand concessions as a condition of the relationship. Soft, be soft on the people and the problem. Hard, be hard on the problem and the people. Soft, trust others. Hard, distrust others. Soft, change your position easily. Hard, dig into your position. Soft, make offers. Hard, make threats. Soft, disclose your bottom line. Hard, mislead as to your bottom line. Soft, accept one-sided losses to reach agreement. Hard, demand one-sided gains as the price of agreement. Soft, search for the single answer, the one they will accept. Hard, search for the single answer, the one you will accept. Soft, insist on agreement. Hard, insist on your position. Soft, try to avoid a contest of will. Hard, try to win a contest of will. Soft, yield to pressure. Hard, apply pressure. Most people see their choice of negotiating strategies as between these two styles. Listening to the examples as presenting a choice, should you be a soft or a hard positional bargainer, or should you perhaps follow a strategy somewhere in between? The soft negotiating game emphasizes the importance of building and maintaining a relationship. Within families and among friends, much negotiation takes place in this way. The process tends to be efficient, at least to the extent of producing results quickly. As each party competes with the other in being more generous and more forthcoming, an agreement becomes highly likely, but it may not be a wise one. The results may not be as tragic as in the O. Henry story about an impoverished couple in which the loving wife sells her hair in order to buy a handsome chain for her husband's watch, and the unknowing husband sells his watch in order to buy beautiful combs for his wife's hair. However, any negotiation primarily concerned with the relationship runs the risk of producing a sloppy agreement. More seriously, pursuing a soft and friendly form of positional bargaining makes you vulnerable to someone who plays a hard game of positional bargaining. In positional bargaining, a hard game dominates a soft one. If the hard bargainer insists on concessions and makes threats while the soft bargainer yields in order to avoid confrontation and insists on agreement, the negotiating game is biased in favor of the hard player. The process will produce an agreement, although it may not be a wise one. It will certainly be more favorable to the hard positional bargainer than to the soft one. If your response to sustained hard positional bargaining is soft positional bargaining, you will probably lose your shirt. There is an alternative. If you do not like the choice between hard and soft positional bargaining, you can change the game. The game of negotiation takes place at two levels. At one level, negotiation addresses the substance. At another, it focuses, usually implicitly, on the procedure for dealing with the substance. The first negotiation may concern your salary, the terms of a lease, or a price to be paid. The second negotiation concerns how you will negotiate the substantive question, by soft positional bargaining, by hard positional bargaining, or by some other method. This second negotiation is a game about a game, a metagame. Each move you make within a negotiation is not only a move that deals with rent, salary, or other substantive questions, it also helps structure the rules of the game you are playing. Your move may serve to keep the negotiations within an ongoing mode, or it may constitute a game-changing move. This second negotiation, by and large, escapes notice because it seems to occur without conscious decision. Only when dealing with someone from another country, particularly someone with a markedly different cultural background, are you likely to see the necessity of establishing some accepted process for the substantive negotiations. But whether consciously or not, you are negotiating procedural rules with every move you make, even if those moves appear exclusively concerned with substance. The answer to the question of whether to use soft positional bargaining or hard is neither. Change the game. At the Harvard Negotiation Project, we have been developing an alternative to positional bargaining, a method of negotiation explicitly designed to produce wise outcomes efficiently and amicably. This method, called principled negotiation, or negotiation on the merits, can be boiled down to four basic points. These four points define a straightforward method of negotiation that can be used under almost any circumstance. Each point deals with a basic element of negotiation and suggests what you should do about it. Point one, people. Separate the people from the problem. Point two, interests. Focus on interests, not positions. Point three, options. Invent multiple options looking for mutual gains before deciding what to do. Point four, criteria. Insist that the result be based on some objective standard. The first point responds to the fact that human beings are not computers. We are creatures of strong emotions who often have radically different perceptions and have difficulty communicating clearly. Emotions typically become entangled with the objective merits of the problem. Taking positions just makes this worse because people's egos become identified with their positions. Making concessions for the relationship is equally problematic because it can actually encourage and reward stubbornness, which can lead to resentment that ends up damaging the relationship. Hence, even before working on the substantive problem, the people problem should be disentangled from it and addressed on its own. Figuratively, if not literally, the participant should come to see themselves as working side by side, attacking the problem, not each other. Hence the first proposition, separate the people from the problem. The second point is designed to overcome the drawback of focusing on people's stated positions when the object of a negotiation is to satisfy their underlying interests. A negotiating position often obscures what you really want. Compromising between positions is not likely to produce an agreement that will effectively take care of the human needs that led people to adopt those positions. The second basic element of the method is focus on interests, not positions. The third point responds to the difficulty of designing optimal solutions while under pressure. Trying to decide in the presence of an adversary narrows your vision. Having a lot at stake inhibits creativity. So does searching for the one right solution. You can offset these constraints by setting aside a designated time within which to think up a wide range of possible solutions that advance shared interests and creatively reconcile differing interests. Hence the third basic point. Before trying to reach agreement, invent options for mutual gain. Where interests are directly opposed, a negotiator may be able to obtain a favorable result simply by being stubborn. That method tends to reward intransigence and produce arbitrary results. However, you can counter such a negotiator by insisting that his single say-so is not enough, and that the agreement must reflect some fair standard, independent of the naked will of either side. This does not mean insisting that the terms be based on the standard you select, but only that some fair standard, such as market value, expert opinion, custom, or law, determine the outcome. By discussing such criteria rather than what the parties are willing or unwilling to do, neither party need give in to the other. Both can defer to a fair solution. Hence the fourth basic point. Insist on using objective criteria. The four propositions of principled negotiation are relevant from the time you begin to think about negotiating until the time either an agreement is reached or you decide to break off the effort. That period can be divided into three stages: analysis, planning, and discussion. During the analysis stage, you are simply trying to diagnose the situation, to gather information, organize it, and think about it. You will want to consider the people problems of partisan perceptions, hostile emotions, and unclear communication, as well as to identify your interests and those of the other side. You will want to note options already on the table and identify any criteria already suggested as a basis for agreement. During the planning stage, you deal with the same four elements a second time, both generating ideas and deciding what to do. How do you propose to handle the people problems? Of your interests, which are most important? And what are some realistic objectives? You will want to generate additional options and additional criteria for deciding among them. Again, during the discussion stage, when the parties communicate back and forth, looking toward agreement, the same four elements are the best subjects to discuss. Differences in perception, feelings of frustration and anger, and difficulties in communication can be acknowledged and addressed. Each side should come to understand the interests of the other. Both can then jointly generate options that are mutually advantageous and seek agreement on objective standards for resolving opposed interests. To sum up, in contrast to positional bargaining, the principled negotiation method of focusing on basic interests, mutually satisfying options, and fair standards typically results in a wise agreement. The method permits you to reach a gradual consensus on a joint decision efficiently, without all the transactional costs of digging into positions, only to have to dig yourself out of them. And separating the people from the problem allows you to deal directly and empathetically with the other negotiator as a human being, regardless of any substantive differences, thus making possible an amicable outcome. Each of the next four chapters expands on one of these four basic points. If at any point you become skeptical, you may want to skip ahead briefly and listen to chapters 6, 7, and 8, which respond to questions commonly raised about the method. Part 2. The Method. Chapter 2. Separate the people from the problem. Everyone knows how hard it is to deal with a problem without people misunderstanding each other, getting angry or upset, and taking things personally. A union leader says to his crew, "All right, who called the walkout?" Jones steps forward. "I did. It was that bum foreman Campbell again. That was the fifth time in 2 weeks he sent me out of our group as a replacement. He's got it in for me and I'm tired of it. Why should I get all the dirty work?" Later, the union leader confronts Campbell. "Why do you keep picking on Jones? He says you've put him on replacement detail 5 times in 2 weeks. What's going on?" Campbell replies, "I picked Jones because he's the best. I know I can trust him to keep things from fouling up in a group without its point person. I send him on replacement only when it's a key person missing. Otherwise, I send Smith or someone else. It's just that with the flu going around, there have been a lot of point people out. I never knew Jones objected. I thought he liked the responsibility." In another real-life situation, an insurance company lawyer says to the state insurance commissioner, "I appreciate your time, Commissioner Thompson. What I'd like to talk to you about is some of the problems we've been having with the presumption clause of the strict liability regulations. Basically, we think the way the clause was written causes it to have an unfair impact on those insurers whose existing policies contain rate adjustment limitations, and we would like to consider ways it might be revised. The commissioner interrupting, Ms. Montero, your company had ample opportunity to voice any objection it had during the hearings my department held on those regulations before they were issued. I ran those hearings, Ms. Montero. I listened to every word of testimony, and I wrote the final version of the strict liability provisions personally. Are you saying I made a mistake? No, but are you saying I'm unfair? Certainly not, sir, but I think this provision has had consequences none of us foresaw, and listen, Montero, I promised the public when I campaigned for this position that I would put an end to killer hair dryers and $10,000 bombs disguised as cars. And these regulations have done that. Your company made a $50 million profit on its strict liability policies last year. What kind of fool do you think you can play me for coming in here talking about unfair regulations and unforeseen consequences? I don't want to hear another word of that. Good day, Ms. Montero. Now what? Does the insurance company lawyer press the commissioner on this point, making him angry and probably not getting anywhere? Her company does a lot of business in this state. A good relationship with the commissioner is important. Should she let the matter rest then, even though she is convinced that this regulation really is unfair, that its long-term effects are likely to be against the public interest, and that not even the experts foresaw this problem at the time of the original hearings? What is going on in these cases? Negotiators are people first. A basic fact about negotiation, easy to forget in corporate and international transactions, is that you are dealing not with abstract representatives of the other side, but with human beings. They have emotions, deeply held values, and different backgrounds and viewpoints, and they are unpredictable. They are prone to cognitive biases, partisan perceptions, blind spots, and leaps of illogic. So are we. This human aspect of negotiation can be either helpful or disastrous. The process of working out an agreement may produce a psychological commitment to a mutually satisfactory outcome. A working relationship where trust, understanding, respect, and friendship are built up over time can make each new negotiation smoother and more efficient. And people's desire to feel good about themselves and their concern for what others will think of them can often make them more sensitive to another negotiator's interests. On the other hand, people get angry, depressed, fearful, hostile, frustrated, and offended. They have egos that are easily threatened. They see the world from their own personal vantage point, and they frequently confuse their perceptions with reality. Routinely, they fail to interpret what you say in the way you intend, and do not mean what you understand them to say. Misunderstanding can reinforce prejudice and lead to reactions that produce counterreactions in a vicious circle. Rational exploration of possible solutions becomes impossible, and a negotiation fails. The purpose of the game becomes scoring points, confirming negative impressions, and apportioning blame at the expense of the substantive interests of both parties. Failing to deal with others sensitively as human beings prone to human reactions can be disastrous for a negotiation. Whatever else you are doing at any point during a negotiation, from preparation to follow-up, it is worth asking yourself, am I paying enough attention to the people problem? Every negotiator has two kinds of interests, in the substance and in the relationship. Every negotiator wants to reach an agreement that satisfies his substantive interests. That is why one negotiates. Beyond that, a negotiator also has an interest in his relationship with the other side. An antiques dealer wants both to make a profit on the sale and to turn the customer into a regular one. At a minimum, a negotiator wants to maintain a working relationship good enough to produce an acceptable agreement and effective implementation, if one is possible given each side's interests. Usually, more is at stake. Most negotiations take place in the context of an ongoing relationship, where it is important to carry on each negotiation in a way that will help rather than hinder future relations and future negotiations. In fact, with many long-term clients, business partners, family members, fellow professionals, government officials, or foreign nations, the ongoing relationship is far more important than the outcome of any particular negotiation. the relationship tends to become entangled with the problem. A major consequence of the people problem in negotiation is that the party's relationship tends to become entangled with their discussions of substance. On both the giving and receiving end, we are likely to treat people and problem as one. Within the family, a statement such as, "The kitchen is a mess," or "Our bank account is low," may be intended simply to identify a problem, but it is likely to be heard as a personal attack. Anger over a situation may lead you to express anger towards some human being associated with it in your mind. Egos tend to become involved in substantive positions. Another reason that substantive issues become entangled with psychological ones is that people draw from comments on substance unfounded inferences, which they then treat as facts about that person's intentions and attitudes toward them. Unless we are careful, this process is almost automatic. We are seldom aware that other explanations may be equally valid. Thus, in the union example, Jones was sure that Campbell, the foreman, had it in for him, while Campbell thought it obvious that he was complimenting Jones and doing him a favor by giving him responsible assignments. Positional bargaining puts relationship and substance in conflict. Framing a negotiation as a contest of will over positions aggravates the entangling process. I see your position as a statement of how you would like the negotiation to end. From my point of view, it demonstrates how little you care about our relationship. If I take a firm position that you consider unreasonable, you assume that I also think of it as an extreme position. It is easy to conclude that I do not value our relationship, or you, very highly. Positional bargaining deals with a negotiator's interests both in substance and in a good relationship by trading one off against the other. If what counts in the long run for your company is its relationship with the insurance commissioner, then you will probably let this matter drop. Yet giving in on a substantive point may buy no friendship. It may do nothing more than convince the other side that you can be taken for a ride. Or, if you care more about a favorable solution than being respected or liked by the other side, you can try to extract concessions by holding the relationship hostage. If you won't go along with me on this point, then so much for you. This will be the last time we meet. While you may extract a concession this way, this strategy often results in lousy substance and a damaged relationship. Disentangle the relationship from the substance. Deal directly with the people problem. Dealing with a substantive problem and maintaining a good working relationship need not be conflicting goals if the parties are committed and psychologically prepared to treat each separately on its own legitimate merits. Base the relationship on mutually understood perceptions, clear two-way communication, expressing emotions without blame, and a forward-looking, purposive outlook. Deal with people problems by changing how you treat people. Don't try to solve them with substantive concessions. To deal with psychological problems, use psychological techniques. Where perceptions differ, look for ways to test assumptions and to educate. If emotions run high, you can find ways for each person involved to let off steam and feel heard. Where misunderstanding exists, you can work to improve communication. To find your way through the jungle of people problems, it is useful to think in terms of three basic categories: perception, emotion, and communication. The various people problems all fall into one of these three baskets. In negotiating, it is easy to forget that you must deal not only with their people problems, but also with your own. Your anger and frustration may obstruct an agreement beneficial to you. Your perceptions are likely to be one-sided, and you may not be listening or communicating adequately. The techniques that follow apply equally well to your people problems as to those of the other side. Perception. Understanding the other side's thinking is not simply a useful activity that will help you solve your problem. Their thinking is the problem. Whether you are making a deal or settling a dispute, differences are defined by the difference between your thinking and theirs. When two people quarrel, they usually quarrel over an object. Both may claim a watch. Or over an event. Each may contend that the other was at fault in causing an automobile accident. The same goes for nations. Morocco and Algeria quarrel over a section of the Western Sahara. India and Pakistan quarrel over each other's development of nuclear bombs. In such circumstances, people tend to assume that what they need to know more about is the object or the event. They study the watch, or they measure the skid marks at the scene of the accident. They study the Western Sahara, or the detailed history of nuclear weapons development in India and Pakistan. Ultimately, however, conflict lies not in objective reality, but in people's heads. Truth is simply one more argument, perhaps a good one, perhaps not, for dealing with the difference. The difference itself exists because it exists in their thinking. Fears, even if ill-founded, are real fears and need to be dealt with. Hopes, even if unrealistic, may cause a war. Facts, even if established, may do nothing to solve the problem. Both parties may agree that one lost the watch and the other found it, but still disagree over who should get it. It may finally be established that the auto accident was caused by the blowout of a tire that had been driven 31,402 miles, but the parties may dispute who should pay for the damage. The detailed history and geography of the Western Sahara, no matter how carefully studied and documented, is not the stuff with which one puts to rest that kind of territorial dispute. No study of who developed what nuclear devices, when, will put to rest the conflict between India and Pakistan. As useful as looking for objective reality can be, it is ultimately the reality as each side sees it that constitutes the problem in a negotiation and opens the way to a solution. Put yourself in their shoes. How you see the world depends on where you sit. People tend to see what they want to see. Out of a mass of detailed information, they tend to pick out and focus on those facts that confirm their prior perceptions and to disregard or misinterpret those that call their perceptions into question. Each side in a negotiation may see only the merits of its case and only the faults of the other sides. The ability to see the situation as the other side sees it, as difficult as it may be, is one of the most important skills a negotiator can possess. It is not enough to know that they see things differently. If you want to influence them, you also need to understand empathetically the power of their point of view and to feel the emotional force with which they believe in it. It is not enough to study them like beetles under a microscope. You need to know what it feels like to be a beetle. To accomplish this task, you should be prepared to withhold judgment for a while as you try on their views. They may well believe that their views are right as strongly as you believe yours are. You may see on the table a glass half full of cool water. Your spouse may see a dirty, half-empty glass about to cause a ring on the mahogany finish. Consider the contrasting perceptions of a tenant and a landlady negotiating the renewal of a lease. The tenant's perceptions, the rent is already too high. Landlady's perceptions, the rent has not been increased for a long time. The tenant thinks, with other costs going up, I can't afford to pay more for housing. While the landlady thinks, with other costs going up, I need more rental income. The tenant, the apartment needs painting. The landlady, he has given that apartment heavy wear and tear. The tenant, I know people who pay less for a comparable apartment. The landlady, I know people who pay more for a comparable apartment. The tenant, young people like me can't afford to pay high rents. The landlady, young people like him tend to make noise and to be hard on an apartment. Tenant, the rent ought to be low because the neighborhood is run down. Landlady, we landlords should raise rents to improve the quality of the neighborhood. The tenant, I'm a desirable tenant with no dogs or cats. Landlady, his loud music drives me crazy. The tenant, I always pay the rent whenever she asks for it. The landlady, he never pays the rent until I ask for it. The tenant, she is cold and distant. She never asks me how things are. The landlady, I am a considerate person who never intrudes on a tenant's privacy. Understanding their point of view is not the same as agreeing with it. It is true that a better understanding of their thinking may lead you to revise your own views about the merits of a situation, but that is not a cost of understanding their point of view. It is a benefit. It allows you to reduce the area of conflict, and it also helps you advance your newly enlightened self-interest. Don't deduce their intentions from your fears. people tend to assume that whatever they fear, the other side intends to do. Consider this story from the New York Times. They met in a bar where he offered her a ride home. He took her down unfamiliar streets. He said it was a shortcut. He got her home so fast she caught the 10 o'clock news.